Yeah, I'd like to start with the Beetle Bill, which, of course, you introduced April 30th, I think, and it went to subcommittee May 4th. What's the current progress on that bill?
Currently, we have gathered numerous co-sponsors, and we've discussed it in a hearing before the House Agriculture Committee that actually occurred in Wyoming. So now we're continuing to discuss the bill with members of Congress, especially members that are from the Intermountain West, to try to get their support and raise the bill's profile. As you know, bark beetles have caused unprecedented devastation to our forests in the West, and we need unique solutions and flexibility for forest managers, so this bill provides that. It picks two forests in each state that can have pilot projects to address bark beetle epidemics, and there are a couple approaches it can take, recovery of areas already destroyed by beetle kill, and hopefully protection of future outbreaks in the green forests that have not already been destroyed.
What kind of response have you gotten from other members of Congress so far? It looked like you were standing pretty much alone on its introduction.
We have gotten more support, especially since the hearing that occurred in Wyoming in the Ag Committee, because the Forest Service, the regional forester, testified that it would be very beneficial to them to have the flexibility that the bill provides. And the Wyoming State Forester testified also about some of the extent of the devastation. The National Forest Service is very aware of the devastation and the extent of it. In fact, the regional forester testified that 100,000 trees per day are falling now that have been killed as a result of the bark beetle. And, of course, some of the worst areas in Wyoming and northern Colorado including more than 1.5 million acres of forest. And it is it's just awful. An additional 1.1 million acres are under attack in northwestern Wyoming, not yet including the Jackson area specifically, but if you get down in the Bridger-Teton, just south of the Snake River, boy, you start really seeing it there.
We're seeing it also on the west side of Teton Pass. It's looking mighty gray over there from the kill. And, of course, it carries a price tag, and I'm watching the expenses being racked up with the oil spill in the Gulf. Is there any kind of a danger that there might be some reluctance to fund the issue?
There is, and that's why the most important part of it, this is the flexibility that it provides. I am actually more bought into the notion that the bill provides for those kinds of working relationships between state foresters, the national foresters, and private entities. So the national forest regional directors and direct supervisors of the forest can contract with private loggers to clear out some of the felled bark beetle destroyed timber that is now preventing the use of trails by hikers and horse packers. And we need to make sure that there's adequate flexibility. The additional funding we're requesting would provide some additional funding resources, but quite frankly, there is felled timber that serves as a source of revenue for the loggers that are able to come in and clear out some of that that dead and dying timber. So I'm hopeful that in some ways there's some revenue sources right within the bill.
So it sounds like there'll be a certain amount of sustainability in the project.
That's the goal, although, of course, the Forest Service is hoping for additional funds. But in the event that because of some of these unanticipated expenses, such as the flooding in Tennessee, such as the environmental disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, that we can provide within the bill some sources of funding for the project.
Since you brought up the flooding in Tennessee and Kentucky, I know you just passed, whether it's a referendum or an expression of sympathy for the flood victims. Is there any kind of monetary assistance that is being considered in Congress?
There is not, but there have been federal disaster designations for every single county between Nashville and Memphis, Tennessee. Furthermore, organizations such as Red Cross, local church organizations and charitable organizations have really rolled up their sleeves and are helping the families of the flood victims and also people whose homes have been destroyed by the floods.
Okay, I've heard some of the country music stars have really been rolling up their sleeves and trying to help out on that. Let me move to the 10th Amendment Task Force that you participated in on May 6th. And I'm wondering what kind of reception the goals of the task force have seen so far since its introduction.
It was very well received in that there were 10 founding members. I was one. We've picked up some other members. And our most immediate goal is to act as Washington watchdogs. The task force plans to scrutinize potential Washington interference brought forth by bills or mandates by the executive branch, whether they're introduced by Republicans or Democrats. And even though it's a new task force, we are looking at proposals and sharing proposals with each other that aim to disperse power and decision-making and taxpayer money from Washington back to states and to individuals. For example, here in my office, we're working on a bill that would allow for the block granting of Medicaid funds to the state of Wyoming and other states if they need the federal strings surrounding those funds loosened so they have the flexibility to tailor health care delivery to the poor in the various states. This bill would provide them that. It provides not a cut in funding, but it provides the same amount of funding with more flexibility, assuming that they can take that money farther and eventually, hopefully, the federal government will not have to continue to administer the program, which is a huge expense to the federal government and a tremendous inefficiency for those states that are trying to provide those services on the local level.
Now, how might the activities of the task force relate to issues of concern here, like protection of our rivers or protection of the Wyoming Range?
Well, the task force, for example, let's take the Wyoming Range issue you mentioned. And an example is the fact that currently the state foresters and the private forests and the federal forests, although they are geographically commingled, doesn't provide for working together on projects. And so these are the kind of things we're hoping to do, is recognize that people on the ground in the local levels have more expertise and are the real watchdogs that are able to assess the needs of our forests, and that transcends forests. You know, you look at it, it's the same as true with regard to programs that are delivered to people, programs that are delivered to wildlife, programs that protect our environment, programs that allow business to thrive and prosper. All of these kinds of things are frequently better delivered at the state level. Certainly, I believe education to be first and foremost among them. So what we want to do, for example, is make sure that education within states is still delivered at the state level, education policy is made at the state level, and that there this continued overreaching by the federal government into areas such as education policy is stopped.
So in addition to keeping an eye on legislation, policies, unfunded mandates, that sort of thing, you're looking at promoting a more cooperative spirit between the federal government and the states, right?
That is exactly true. We are especially going to be looking at the role the federal government plays in this health care delivery system that just passed pursuant to a 2,700-page bill that very few people in this country understand, including members of the House of Representatives. As you know, that was a Senate-originated bill. It was never debated in the House. We simply voted for it without the types of amendments and debates that normally occurred that help inform the discussion. So those of us in the House are trying to learn what the ramifications of that Senate bill that is now law will be on our various states. And certainly we believe that there are provisions in the bill that will threaten states' rights and individual rights, such as requiring individuals to purchase a government-approved product, being health insurance.
I know with No Child Left Behind, having been in the classroom for a number of years, it really interfered with, especially in rural classrooms, what the people, with the teachers, what the cooperation with the parents could do because of things that they were mandated to do.
And I hear from more and more teachers who are in their 50s, have been teaching their entire career, so they're the people that I went to college with and was educated with and stayed in Wyoming. They tell me to a person that we are over-testing our kids, that the commitment that the kids have to those tests, because some matter and some don't, affects the performance on the test. And for the teachers to continually test in ways that don't necessarily advance the educational experience of the classroom is really discouraging a lot of good Wyoming teachers, experienced Wyoming teachers, and quite frankly is interfering with the education of some of our children. So yes, we need accountability on our schools, absolutely. But this is one instance where I believe the pendulum has swung too far, and we need to allow states to assess classrooms and the teachers in them and student progress in a way that makes sense in each state.
And it has taken an awful lot of creativity out of the classroom. Some very creative teachers can't pursue some of the things they used to.
Teaching to the test is a common complaint I hear from teachers, and you are correct. Some of the more creative teachers have found this particularly burdensome. You know, each of us can think of a teacher that had a dramatic influence on our lives, either the career direction that we chose or that just woke us up to the benefits of pursuing a course of study that we may not have contemplated. And it is unfortunate that those kinds of relationships seem to be stifled by this constant testing, teaching to the test, and evaluation that transcends the creativity in the classroom.
Now, of course, we're quite a few miles away from you, and you see a lot of things going across your desk. America competes reauthorization, as I mentioned, the sympathy for the flood victims, things that we don't normally see. What sorts of things do you have on your mind that perhaps we haven't heard of yet?
Well, I have a bill that I'll be filing next week with one of my colleagues, Sam Johnson from Texas. Sam Johnson was a prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton during the Vietnam War, a distinguished and decorated fighter pilot. Sam and I have put in a bill that will, and we'll be filing it next week, that will allow for the downsizing of the federal employees, the number of employees, over time using attrition. And here's how it works. Every time a federal employee vacates a position, either due to retirement or moving on in their career, that position would go into a position pool. three of the four positions put into the pool would continue to exist. One out of the four positions would be eliminated. And then federal agencies would have to compete to get positions back from the position pool and justify the need for more employees. You know, as we've studied this, there was a steady decline in the number of employees the country has until about 2001, right after those years where we had a balanced budget. And then it has skyrocketed since 2009 and 2010, particularly 2010, and was level during the years roughly 2003, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so this massive increase in federal employees includes some people that were hired pursuant to the government stimulus package. But, of course, we have less people in the private sector. We've lost jobs in the private sector. And we have more people in the public sector, more jobs in the public sector. And the private sector is trying to support, through its tax dollars, these new employees in the public sector at a time when we're borrowing more and more money from countries like China and Japan. So we have to reverse this trend. We want to do it without hurting federal employees. That's why we've chosen to use attrition as the means to reduce the number of federal positions. So we'll be filing that bill next week, and we're already garnering co-sponsors.
It sounds like we're trying to get the government to play by the same rules as private enterprise.
Amen. If you look at the chart of federal employment, it's in a U-shape with the end of the U representing 2010, the very, very high end. And then you can lay over it the trend lines for the private sector, and they're an upside-down U. They're going in opposite directions at precisely the same time. So private sector employment precipitously declines, federal government employment has precipitously increased. And that is a recipe for disaster in these tough economic times for our country.
Well, we'll have to watch for the filing of that. I appreciated your time today. It's always a delight to be talking with you.
I so appreciate the time you've given me. I was in Jackson over the weekend. Had a chance to visit with some folks there talking about the economy, talking about this bark beetle bill, and I'll be back frequently, of course, in the coming months as I begin my campaign, and we'll be seeing you frequently. So thank you for your time today.